everybody. This is Colin, and welcome to episode 10 on the Abstract Podcast. Today, we'll catch up on March Madness stuff, and then we have a guest on the show to talk through the new Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma. Stay tuned. All right, welcome everybody to episode 10, and welcome Lawrence.
Thank you for having me, Javen.
Yeah, this is the first time we've had a guest on all season.
All season?
Question mark? I think so. It's been too long. Yeah, and we're glad that you are with us. So we wanted to start off with a joke that Colin heard that we are waiting for with bated breath while we drink bubbly.
So this was from, I don't know why, it's funnier because it's from an Anglican.
Okay. That probably means nothing to most of the people.
But he asked, what is the difference between a kiss and a holy kiss?
Oh boy, this is good. Okay, I have no idea.
Lawrence, anything?
I have no idea.
3 minutes. There it is.
Because a holy kiss lasts for 3 minutes?
No.
Or doesn't last for 3 minutes?
Okay. I think.
Okay. I think I get what you're saying. Seriously, a holy kiss is more of a peck.
I don't know why it kind of struck me as funny when I, especially because he's like, you know, very high churchy and something about him making.
So
that
does
joke.
The high church practice the holy kiss?
Not many of them, I don't think.
No,
does your church?
No, I'm Episcopalian.
Is that a higher
we
church?
We do not do the holy kiss, but I do know in some Roman Catholic settings that's done.
Yeah.
Well, and like the church that I grew up in, like when I was like. 0 through 8. The holy kiss was a thing, man.
I remember my church.
I remember stories of people like trying to avoid that thing.
Yeah,
nasty.
I remember like the church when I was really young. The church we went to, a few of the older brethren would, but I would primarily see it when I'd visit other churches or like church conferences. That's where I really saw it. So,
yeah.
Fine.
All right.
You can see on where we fall on that liturgy.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay, so for the March Madness tournament, so my brother Luke sent me this message, and he was kind of lamenting the fact that I guess it's true that as you move throughout the bracket, it gets worth more and more.
Absolutely.
So he was kind of upset because he's still our leader. Chips Ahoy is ahead with, where does it say the points? 760 points, is that right? Help me out. Nope, 220.
I was going to say, that seems really high.
No, he had 220 from 64.
Okay.
Yeah, he has 760 points, and he's the leader right now. He was saying, like, if you get the games right early on, it doesn't count near as much as it does towards the end. And he was like, that's stupid because Gonzaga, as a winner, is a pretty solid pick.
Right.
You get so much for that, and so many people have picked that. But he's like, I called a lot of these upsets that happened early on. So he feels like he's getting ripped off. But needless to say, I'm not disappointed because I have moved from 14th place up to 7th place.
Oh, wow.
And most importantly, Michigan lost last night. That was Alicia's champion. I am now beating my wife in March Madness. So this is a good day.
Wait, who do you have winning?
Gonzaga.
Okay. Okay.
So,
how many of your final four are still in?
Yeah, I don't know. Who's in the final four? Let me pull up my bracket real quick.
Houston, Baylor, Gonzaga, and UCLA.
Okay, I got Gonzaga and Baylor.
Okay.
Wait, no. It's even better than that. I have Gonzaga and Baylor. Yep, no, that's it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's crossed out. I was like, I called UCLA? What?
Yeah.
No, yeah.
Yeah, no.
So,
I have 3 of 4.
Didn't see West Virginia and didn't see Michigan lasting that long. I mean, UCLA.
UCLA, yeah. I had Bama in their spot.
Ooh,
so they took that one down, but... I have Baylor, Houston, and Gonzaga. So still
well done.
3 of 4.
Yeah.
So we'll see.
I mean, who could call the 11 seed in there? So
I know. Who got that one right?
So
they were a hot team coming
in. Do you have your point total right there?
No.
Oh,
no, I did it just on paper. So I'll have to go back and calculate it by hand.
Yeah, so basically the bottom 7 people in our bracket, all their champions are out. So condolences to you guys.
They're done.
And Riley still rounding out the bottom with 370 points.
Which he had Illinois? Or no, Ohio State.
He had Ohio State, so that was tough. And then all the top 7 have Gonzaga winning. So I don't really know that I can gain a lot of ground at this point. So keep yourself tuned into that because the winner is getting the $15 DQ gift card. Second place is getting the Abstract Podcast mug, which probably should be
the last one we have in stock.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. All right. So this episode, we wanted to talk about The Social Dilemma. This was a movie that I saw Lawrence watching here in the publications room, and then I watched it, and then Colin watched it. All but 8 minutes, right?
All but like the last 8 minutes, yeah. Yes.
So we wanted to talk about The Social Dilemma. But first of all, before we get to that, I want to ask you guys, all seniors, all in the home stretch here, how are you guys doing?
I am just making it. I think I totally underestimated how stressful and compact this semester would be. And so with just 3 weeks left, I'm really feeling the burn. So Friday, although it's supposed to be a rest day and Good Friday, it looks like it's a work Friday.
Bad Friday.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I feel that. Okay, Colin?
Yeah. Pretty good. Same kind of boat. The next 3 weeks look pretty big. Although I do have, tomorrow's my last day in my placement, so then I'll be done with my student teaching completely.
Yeah.
And so I basically have like four writing projects to finish up then in the next 3 weeks. So, and then, well, actually, okay, four writing projects, and then I have to take the Georgia ethics assessment for educators yet too. So it'll be a busy 3 weeks, but it looks doable. I told my wife the other day, it's like, once you're like, now that I'm far enough along, I've seen this every semester for the past 4 years, and I see this, what it looks like, insurmountable,
yeah, just a
burden to do. And you chip away at it, and you come to the end of the semester, and you're like, hey, I did it. And so yeah. You kind of build in this confidence. It's like, I look at it, and it looks kind of overwhelming, but I know I can get it done.
Yeah, I was just having the same thought, because I'm at a position where I have things that are due tomorrow, and it's like, I feel like earlier in my career, if we can call it that, I'd be freaking out. But at this point, I'm like, I'll just write the papers tomorrow. It's fine. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure I can get it done one day. So yeah. Be a busy day tomorrow.
Yeah. You do feel like you've got more in the reservoir to pull from.
Yeah. I feel, I guess that's what college is supposed to do. I do feel more competent. It's like, I can do that in one day. I can make that happen.
Yep.
Okay, so let's get into this. The Social Dilemma is a film. It's a documentary on Netflix. When did you guys say it came out?
I think it came out in 2020, I believe. Because it within the film, it references COVID. So that would have been, I mean, that would have had to at least finish production.
Yeah, so it's like pretty recent.
Time. Yeah.
So, wow, just a really, really interesting film. I thought really a lot of cause for contemplation. And so we'll just kind of dive into what it made us think, what we've seen in it. And so we've kind of broken it down to in kind of three segments that we're going to go down through. The first one is that this film go ahead.
If I can interrupt for just a second, we could maybe just set it up. And this film is, it's a documentary, but it a lot of it focuses on interviewing people who have worked at major tech corporations like Google, Facebook, et cetera. And it's basically there's a few that have seen some of the effects of their own algorithms that they've constructed or their work that they did,
right.
And are wanting to now kind of own it and call for their own industries to own it and just be aware and kind of map out the cultural moment we're in. And so it cycles through, whether it's because you even have some psychologists referenced in it, and it's a lot of just understanding how tech has shaped society's collective brain or collective sense of self.
Yeah, great clarification. Good point. Yeah, they have. So help me remember who all is in this thing. I remember there's, I think it was the CEO of Pinterest was on there.
Yes, the main guy's Tristan, or is that how you
say
it?
Yeah,
yeah. But he was from Google.
He was from Google.
Yeah.
The guy who engineered the Facebook like button was on there.
Yeah.
The former CEO of Pinterest.
Yes.
You also have representatives from Snapchat.
Instagram.
And Instagram.
The one girl was like foundation, like at the start of Instagram, she was there.
Then you had economists, social psychologists, Jonathan Haidt, and then
so I guess
there's one or two other things.
Yeah, the point is, like, these aren't just people who have come out of the woods and being like, hey, like, this is a bad idea. Like, these are people who were there at the beginning building these things.
Right.
Who, like, they even say, like, we thought we were building something that was a driving force for good in the world. And, like, now they're reevaluating and saying, yeah, I'm not sure that's the case. And they're not working for those companies anymore, or they're seriously reevaluating. So yeah, that's kind of a good way to frame. Did you have something?
Yeah, I just wanted to point out, I found it particularly interesting that most of these people went in to build a product that would service other people, and what they recognized is that the product so essentially made the person and not the other way around. And so just to have that insight was really powerful, and it spoke to me throughout the film.
Absolutely. So the first thing we want to talk about is the problem with the business model. So Lawrence, do you want to kind of take us through this or start us on this one? Because they talked about basically just the advertising model for generating revenue.
Correct. And that's something that we see play out, especially now with the advent of digital marketing. You have basically advertisers who pay for the attention span of consumers and users of these platforms. And that's really where Google and different tech companies make their money. It's from their subscribers. And so in an effort to, you know, retain the max amount of people for the longest period of time, they had to be a little bit more inventive in how they were doing that. And again, although the objective could be considered wholesome and good, what they found out was that it was more detrimental than it was helpful.
Yes. So, quote here, the main problem with the social internet is that it is built upon a revenue-generating system that uses attention and engagement as its fuel and generates a toxic byproduct of manipulation. And I just can't help but think about how completely native that this is to us. Like, and especially, like, I think about my little brother who grew up even a more digital technology native than me. Like, we don't even think of it as weird at all that before we watch any video, we have to watch an advertisement. Or that if you want to watch a documentary on something, you can watch for 15 minutes and then you're going to watch like a 30-second ad. And that if we're watching sporting events, I mean, you're going to watch probably 20, 30 minutes worth of ads as you go through the events. Like, this is just the way the world is, advertising all the time.
Right.
And that's the business model. Like, that's how you make money. And like, so if you're successful on YouTube, they're like, hey, you're successful. So now we're advertise on the things you're producing, so that we can make money and you can make money. It's just, that's the business model, is that it's attention, buying attention.
Right. And I think that's one of the things that the film pulls back the curtain on, and how when we observe that and like we take in an advertisement, we assume that the advertisers are trying to sell us something.
Yeah, like that's the main goal.
That's the main impetus of it. But I think what this documentary does is it kind of pulls that back and says, you know, that might be down the list of priorities, but the biggest thing that's on sale right now is your attention. And the algorithms are designed in a way that are to keep your engagement and your attention as long as possible and to sell it to these advertising companies for the highest bid. Like, you are the product. You are not, you know, they're not trying to convince you to buy a product as much as they are wanting just your attention.
Yeah, that was probably like the thing that I'll remember from this film the most, because I always kind of thought, like, I don't know, it's like I see like Marathon Oil commercials, but it's like you just kind of think like this is something I have to get through to get to what I want to see, and it's not even going to affect me.
Yeah.
But I guess like the psychology of it, it's so proven that if we see things, it does affect us. So they're selling our attention knowing that this does make a difference. And so I really liked how if you watch the film, you kind of see they have like a little bit of a there's like a story that kind of weaves throughout the documentary, correct, like with actors and stuff. And so you just see this kid, and like there's these you guys can help me describe it, but like there's these three guys who kind of represent the algorithm.
It's kind of like an Inside Out, you know, you have like the voices inside your head. It's kind of like that, but these three voices are inside it's the algorithm for what these three voices are.
And so like they're the ones who control what shows up on his phone.
Right.
And so their goal is if they can get him on his phone, then they can sell the advertisements. Sell his attention to the advertisers. So like they'll like hit the button, they'll be like, bam, sold for 5.5 cents to a certain company. And so the insight that this guy gave, he was the guy with the long dreads. He was like, whenever you're not sure what's being sold, if it seems free, you can safely assume that you are what's being sold. It's your attention that's being sold by these social media platforms to businesses for money. And it seems free to you, but you're actually the product.
Yeah, and social media is just so immersive in nature that you sort of lose a consciousness of that. So it should come almost as no surprise that this is what happens because it was designed in that way. And even the best of us, the most articulate, the smartest, the most aware people lose that sense of consciousness that I have now become the product.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll get to that maybe a little bit more in a minute, but I was just amazed. The guy, it was the Pinterest guy, I think, he was saying, like, I'm designing this platform and these algorithms at work, but then I find that I come home and I can't stay off my phone. Like,
right.
The very thing I can't even design, put it down.
Yeah. It's taking me captive.
Absolutely. Yeah. So do we have anything more to say about the business model? Like, I'm trying to think, I don't know a lot about business. How else could have it been, right? Like, what's another way it could have been done? Because I guess, like, I remember Facebook's thing is it's free and always will be. Like, when you log in, that was kind of on the home screen. So, I mean, I guess an alternate model would have been charge people to use Facebook, generate the income from gaining users, and then don't bother with advertising.
Right. But I think that was, that, like, even within the film itself, like, the argument was not that the monetization of this data is what the problem is. It's how these algorithms are developed. When I think their big thing, which we'll get into the second point, but the bigger problem than monetizing it is the problem of how these algorithms are competing with each other to try, like, there is a significant benefit in basically manipulating our attention to be more and more absorbed into, like, into one area. And I think I should just hold with that thought there, because we'll get into that with the second thing we want to talk about.
To your point, Javen, of another, I can't imagine another way that this would sort of play out. And again, just using the digital marketing example, I mean, you go on, you know, Google Ads or Facebook Ads. That's really where they make their money. And as a marketer, I'm able to say, okay, this content really resonates with people. I can sell it pretty cheaply, just a couple of cents to get this person who's going to give me way more money than I spent on this ad. I think on the level that it is a business model, that's probably one of the most cost-effective thing for any marketer, any advertiser. So I can't imagine it any other way. But yeah, it is something to sort of think about.
So let's move from talking about the business model itself more into the second point that we have. And it's that social media, or more specifically the internet, is no longer a tool, but an addiction machine. And I thought this was an interesting perspective. I forget her name, but it was kind of the younger girl from Instagram. Mm-hmm. She mentioned that, like, in the beginning days of the internet was, like, kind of where maybe more like artsy or weird types of people went to do really creative things, and kind of far out creative stuff was what happened on the internet. That's not at all what it is now. I mean, I'm sure that stuff's also there, but the internet is just everything. And so they describe it as a transition from a tool to an addiction machine.
Right. And I think the one important thing that is a helpful distinction is, even, I think we maybe even referenced it earlier, but like, I was just remembering the guy who designed the like button, or the like feature for Facebook, talks about how, like, the whole goal for him with the like button, the idea behind it was for, I think what he says exactly is to spread love and positivity, I think is the exact quote. But they were not nefarious motives.
Right.
But I think, you know, with what we're talking about here, how it can be so addictive and actually can change, I think it's as Jonathan Haidt points out something about how it actually changes the psyche, and how our brain even functions and perceives information. Because I think anybody would be really alarmed. They go through a couple of statistics for teenage depression, teenage suicide, and it is astronomical. And then I thought that was, there's really interesting correlation between, so they show the charts of teen depression, teen suicide, which spike incredibly at 2010, I believe is when it was. And they correlate that with another chart from 2010, which is computer computation ability.
Yeah.
You remember that chart? Yeah. And it shows it also in 2010. And I think it jumped. Do you remember what the number was? It is astronomical, the amount of increase.
I remember, like, graph was just going straight up.
Right, and it's way over the millions, like, percent leap in just, I mean, like, in a couple years.
Our ability to process data just
right, but they point
out how and then that was
how
correlated.
Computers were able to compute such a larger number of such a larger number of data, but at the same time, humans did not change and evolve with that change.
Yes, yeah.
And we
yes.
still are where we're at and can only compute what we can compute before that change happened. Which I think kind of set the stage for how we talk about addiction through this.
Yeah, and talking about like the like button, like we were saying, they kind of have this narrative side, like the kind of fictitious story that goes along with the documentary. And so the point here was like, there's the girl who like makes a post on social media. It doesn't really get any likes. She feels super down about this. Mm-hmm. And so like she quickly deletes the post, makes a new post, uses new filters, and like throws herself out there in a different way, gets tons of likes, feels that affirmation. And so it's like, the like button was built, I guess, to spread love and positivity, but it just creates this mechanism where, like, that's what people are going for now. And if you don't get that, then you feel depressed.
Yeah, it almost makes one question themselves. It's a gauge for how good they are in their life, how great their life is. And I think that it was really interesting just seeing that character. She was the youngest one in her family. And just going through some like really tough stuff. I mean, just the social comparison. Mm-hmm. And there's another scene where she's literally addicted. I think the mom puts all phones during the dinner table into this like lockbox, and you know she just aggressively breaks it and is like, no, I need this. This is like part of me. If I don't have it, then there's something wrong. To see that addictive nature to her device, and to see how she sort of responds to the affirmations that she gets from the online mm-hmm. community, I think it's one that we can all recognize.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting just to also point out and highlight that humans haven't evolved as fast as our technology has. And in fact, I was speaking with Professor Grieving. We had sat down and we're having a conversation about the way that technology has sort of like picked up, and we were talking about polarization as well. And we both came to the conclusion that technology is through. We looked at this longitudinally and said that, you know, throughout history, humans were able to sort of experience a gradual increase in both intelligence and the way they're able to like deal with technology. But our current technological advances have happened so rapidly that the human mind, the human brain hasn't been able to adjust for what we've created. And so we're kind of in like a weird transitional phase of understanding like, okay, this is what's happening, but how do we actually deal with it?
Right. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you guys, when you think of, we talk about addiction and, you know, especially prevalent in like teenage years, maybe you guys know, but like, what would be your guess for how many hours per day teens are on their phone on average?
Between 8 and 10.
Oh, no. Like, definitely, like, 13, 14.
Oh, wow. You guys are like, no. It's, like, it's 7.5 hours. That's the number I got. Wow. I guess you guys are much more pessimistic. I guess. I was like, probably, like, 3.5, 4 hours a day.
Yeah.
I was speaking from my own experience. I have, like, a little... it's legit, like, 13, 14 hours.
Yikes. It made me think of Malcolm Gladwell has this thing about the 10,000 hour rule. Like he says, like, that's how long it takes you to master something. So like if you're going to play the violin or write code or whatever you want to do, 10,000 hours is like how long it takes. But I mean, if you think about, we have a 24 hour time period. We probably need to sleep about 8 of it. And then you spend 8 doing, I don't know, feeding yourself and working or something. Mm-hmm. And then like that other 8 hours, kids are just on their phones. Like, if you were to do something creative, not that everything on your phone is uncreative, but, like, if you were to point that energy at something, you could reach 10,000 hours. It wouldn't take very fast, that long. Yeah. So,
no, you were
– yeah, go sorry. Ahead.
No, you're mentioning the girl in that story, like this teen girl who's looking for the affirmation, because that has been – like, I mean, that's kind of – that's the air I breathe in a lot of ways. I work with teen students all the time, and so I get to see – their interactions, all this kind of stuff, how they handle their phones. But I would say what has fascinated me this year, fascinated and semi-disturbed me, is a lot of I'm not focusing on one sex versus another, but as far as girl drama in my classes, a lot of it happens virtually, mm-hmm. and we have to try to work that stuff out from the problems that have arisen from when they've gone home and are on their phones, whether that's cyberbullying, whatever else.
Mm. And it's totally intangible for you, right?
Right, and there's not much we can touch with that, but we're left to kind of deal, pick up the pieces. Whereas you rewind the clock a ways, you know, you had to keep up that image at school, but when you go home, you can kind of drop the charade a little bit.
Yeah.
And
you, like, can you just have to be the bully on the playground.
Right.
Yeah. And then it's over.
Yeah. And you only have to act tough on the playground, or put you only have to construct an identity for this given time of the day.
Yeah.
With social media, and I would say most of the students I teach are on at least four probably different platforms. That's just anecdotal, but it's constant identity construction, and you can just see it happen in real time. And the way that has impacted relationships, I'm seeing it in many different ways, but I'm just saying for middle school girls, the way I've seen it there is a lot of the drama and the problems have come outside of school
mm-hmm.
and come from a different platform. So that's been fascinating. And it's one thing I always had to keep in mind, just that, you know, the generation that is the middle school, like they are true digital natives. Yeah. Like this is mm-hmm. the air they breathe. They don't know any other world. I barely know a world outside of that, but they don't know even the little bit that I do. And they're being parented by parents who have not had to parent or have any advice through parenting. They're shooting from the hip too.
Yeah.
And like I try to keep that in the back of my mind, because when frustrations arise, as they often do, like that, in a lot of ways, it's just tough to be a kid right now. And I don't say that in an alarmist or nostalgic way. It's just tough.
Absolutely.
And one thing that would guide me sometimes is I'd be driving on my way to or from school in the mornings to teach, is I would listen to this song by, I don't know if you know the band Arcade Fire.
Yeah, I do.
They have a song called Creature Comfort. Mm-hmm. And like that was just kind of, I let that song kind of just roll through me and kind of prime me for engagement. But it's called Creature Comfort, but yeah, it basically goes through the plight of what a teenager faces these days. And like the main chorus of the song is, God make me famous, just make it painless.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that song.
Yeah.
So another thing this makes me think of is, you guys have heard of Neil Postman?
I'm sure
at some point, sure, the name. But he wrote this book called The Disappearance of Childhood. And Postman's argument is that children, by definition, are those who don't know the secrets of the world. Like, adults keep secrets from children, which allows children to have childhood. And these are things like about the brutality and, like, hostile nature of the world. Also, like, secrets about, like, sex and, like, things that are adult mm-hmm. content, right. material. Right. And then also, like, I think maybe the other one's, like, how to read. So, like, these are secrets that, I mean, I'm really generalizing. I would really encourage people to read the book. I had to read it for a class. And it was super good. But basically what's happening is, with the internet and when you're giving kids smartphones when they're, like, 3 years old, they literally can't have childhood, because there's no limit on the information they have access mm-hmm. to at all. Or that's Postman's argument. So he's saying the disappearance of childhood happens when those secrets are no longer kept. Like,
right.
everything is given to a kid. They can know anything they want whenever they want. And I think that's why it's so impossible for kids right. to be kids, like you're saying, in middle school, because it never goes away, and they have access to everything all the time. So they have to deal with adult problems
right.
way before their brains are capable of dealing with adult problems.
Yeah. David Brooks kind of piggybacks on that idea in his book, The Second Mountain, in which he kind of outlines about how messaging has followed that same model then, like two kids, two teenagers, like, you know, an axiom to live by if you're a modern teenager is, your possibilities are endless. Follow your heart, shoot for the stars. You know, all your options are wide open mm-hmm. to you. And it's the same kind of model in our messaging as what's in the social media. Like, everything's available to
yeah.
you. Not just social media, but internet in general. Like, you have access to everything. And it creates, I mean, I've never experienced the level of anxiety that I see with my students. Like,
mm-hmm.
because there's not, The path forward has so many options that the anxiety then is, which path do I choose?
So let's talk,
the hard part.
Let's talk a little bit about this. So while everything is wide open and accessible to us, there are very specific things which are, like, while we do have technically the capability to see everything, what we're actually given and the world we're presented with is very narrow and specific. And so,
right, that's the fascinating thing. Like, you have this paradigm where all is open, but at the same time, why is you have that tendency, but at the same time, there's a tendency to groupthink and to find your silo and polarization.
Yes.
Et cetera.
So one of the, me and Lawrence were talking about this, one of the examples they showed was, and the film is kind of, I guess it takes the perspective that climate change is an obvious phenomenon in the world that science has shown. And I know, like, some people disagree about that, and probably a lot of our listeners wouldn't take that paradigm. But that's an example. If you believe that climate change is, like, a real thing, when you start typing into Google, climate change is, depending on what city in the world you're typing that in, you're going to get different predictive text. And sometimes it's going to say a hoax. Sometimes it's going to say
the end of the
kill
world.
Us all.
Yeah.
And so it's like the example they made was social media is serving us. It's serving the function of Wikipedia, but it's acting as if every time you search for something, you get a different article. It's like when you search for something on Wikipedia, everyone who types in a certain query is going to get the same article that pops up, and you're going to get the same facts. They're saying with social media or the internet in general, when you type in a question, the answers are not the same for everyone.
Right.
And so
it's
this might have been a quote, or I might have just paraphrased. It's easy to think it's just a few stupid people who get convinced of, like, conspiracy theories, that kind of thing. But the algorithms are built to take you down rabbit holes. So some of examples would be, like, flat earthers, right?
Right.
Who was the basketball player who kind of came out and said,
Kyrie Irving.
Yeah, sorry, guys, I got in a rabbit hole, and that was really stupid. But, like, he convinced a lot of people that the earth was flat, and it was stupid.
Yeah.
And another example was Pizzagate. Right. So there's, like, these rabbit
holes. This was fascinating because that was kind of the origin of, like, the guy on Reddit who basically began QAnon. Like, this was his baby that got him rolling.
Like,
Pizzagate. He convinced this guy that this pizza parlor is in D.C. or New York,
D.C.
Is a secret pedophile ring for Hillary Clinton.
And down in the basement, they're, like, abusing children.
Yeah. When you order a pizza, it's actually code for ordering a child kind of thing. And so he takes a rifle into this pizza parlor to the basement. There's no basement. He gets arrested. There's nothing there.
But the idea is that this fake piece of propaganda, it does not stay isolated. It spreads to people. The algorithm shows it to people who are likely to be interested, probably puts an ad before it, right? Shows ads on the page, sells it to people, or sells the attention of the people who are looking. And this, I mean, this has really real-world consequences. It leads to a guy showing up in Washington, D.C. with a rifle, determined to liberate the children in the bottom of a pizza parlor. The pizza parlor doesn't even have a basement. It's completely bullcrap. Like, it's just completely made up. And then I think one thing that we kind of miss, or I kind of miss as an American, is, like, in other countries, this also has huge implications. Was it Myanmar?
Yeah, the refugee crisis. Yes.
Like, basically, the only internet they have is Facebook. And, like, the mass killings that happened, maybe you could say more about why they happened, but basically because people got taken down Facebook algorithm rabbit trails and ended up believing things that were just completely not true and killing a lot of people.
Right. Well, and that's the idea behind the algorithm, is you show them one video and the attention based off of that, you know, and I think that was the really interesting yet alarming thing, is that these designers who were talking about the algorithms they made, basically these are algorithms, though, they keep developing and evolving until they get smarter than can be controlled, until they get smarter than their creator.
No, that's
basically
a really important point, is that these things are not just,
like, humans,
they
cannot,
don't stay the same.
Right.
They're not static.
They're not static. They're exactly. Algorithms
they're
are dynamic,
changing.
Constantly getting smarter. They're not getting less good at predicting what's going to keep our attention.
And like, it eventually gets to the point, though, where humans have no control over it besides unplugging, basically.
I think
the creator doesn't.
Like, that's such a good point. And I remember hearing one time, I was on a car trip. I was listening, and it was just on the radio. It was some talk show that was on. It was some guy arguing that basically technology is going to overtake us, and we're going to be basically subjected to it. And I was like, that's really stupid. I don't see how that could ever happen. Because in my mind, it was like robots are going to get smarter than people and make us their slaves. And I was like, that's stupid. But that's really not the paradigm we're talking about here. You have to understand it from more of a perspective of the AI learns from us and gets smarter than us.
Right.
And subjugates us in a very different way.
And that's why they said our focus has a lot of times been on how AI could get stronger than or larger than human strength, as in, you know, the kind of robots take over our jobs, takes over manual labor, et cetera, et cetera.
Real steel.
Right, yeah. But he says instead what we've missed is when it gets below human weak or above human weakness, mm-hmm. which is basically this kind of soft way of controlling us in ways that happens at the subconscious level, in ways it shapes our brain with confirmation bias by designing algorithms that are tailored to our tastes and showing us more people who think like us and further polarizing everyone.
Yeah, so, and I think that weakness really is when we segment humans too much, and I mean this speaks to what happened with the Flat Earth movement, with Pizzagate, and with the travesty out in Myanmar. It really does boil down, if you want to be reductionistic in your understanding of it, it boils down to the way that we've segmented humans, divided them, and the technology then runs on autopilot, and the same thing happens over and over again. So it's so important to take a moment to like step back, have this level of awareness mm-hmm. to say this is the trend that's happening. And it's what these guys did, guys and gals, did in this documentary.
So Lawrence, what did you think of, this was striking to me. Several of them made the point that they do not, these people who engineered these social media platforms absolutely do not let their kids use social media.
I think for good reason. I think, yeah, okay, when I saw that part, there was a, I'm forgetting his name, but I believe he was from Google. He's the guy in the blue t-shirt. I mean, they're all just like,
yeah, I think I remember him. T-shirts. Yeah.
But he's speaking about, you know, how he's recognized this as like being dangerous. And I think, yeah, that's actually like a no-brainer that he wouldn't allow his kids to use it, or he at least imposed like guidelines mm-hmm. for the use with his kids. And I almost want to say that that's something that we should just universally have going on. We should impose and not to say that social media is like all types of wrong. I think that we recognize the problems, but I also think that it's important to sort of like set up these guidelines and boundaries. So something that I've recently started to do, I don't sleep with my phone anymore. I have a bathroom that's right next door to me, and I plug in my phone into the bathroom every single night, and you know, an hour before bed, I don't have to worry about that. I think that there is a psychological correlation between how we develop as people and how much time we do spend on social media. And so, yeah, I thought that he noticed the trend and said, all right, we have to be a little proactive. We need like these guardrails on. And kudos to them for enforcing that.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, like, if I remember right, a lot of what his alarm was is basically, I forget which guy it was, but pointed out, like, you get, the addiction comes in that you actually get a dopamine hit, you know, like every time you get one of these notifications, like a semi high almost. And like, that's where the addiction comes in. Cause he was in the storyline, it focuses then on like how it gets the kid back. The kid tries to give up his phone for a week or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the algorithm is trying to figure out ways to get him to engage again. And so it shoots him a notification of how his ex now is in a relationship.
Yeah.
And he can't help but go on. And it's, yeah, it's almost like he and the one guy that created, I think it was the guy who created the like button, like he talked about how he himself, like, he didn't want to, but his willpower was not enough to keep him off his phone. Something else had to happen because it was just such an addiction machine. So yeah.
Okay, we can stop right here. I'll cut this out. No, there was something I really wanted to say that I can't remember what I was thinking. What were you just saying right before that?
What did I just say?
It was about Ben. It was like dopamine.
Oh yeah, yeah. When he gets his ex contacts him or the pops up his notification.
Oh yeah, okay, I know what it was. So he points out the one part that the way notifications are delivered to you is not an accident at all. He says they came up with the idea of getting people to tag each other in pictures. That way the notifications would branch out and you have more people more involved in their phone. He's like, there's a very specific reason why it says John Smith tagged you in a photo and doesn't show you the photo. He's like, it could easily show you the photo with the notification, but it doesn't do that. It wants you to tap, open up the app, become engaged, see some ads, and keep scrolling.
Then, you get emailed about all your notifications. Mm-hmm. So it's on two different platforms just right there.
I know. Sometimes when I haven't been on a social media or just an app for a while, even Buffalo Wild Wings, relentless advertising.
Yeah.
The notifications they send me are so stupid. It's what? They just want you so badly to come back and give them their attention so that they can sell it. All right. So the third kind of segment we wanted to do here is, this has been rather dark and gloomy.
Which, it continues because we're going to talk about what do we do now with all this stuff.
Yeah, what now?
But that was the thing in the film. A lot of these creators, it was a fairly dark take for them too. The one guy, he was the only way I see this ending is civil war.
I think he said
if there's no intervention.
But wouldn't you say that thousands of people mobbing the government buildings in Washington D.C. is pretty close to something very civil war-esque for sure.
Or even what happened in Myanmar. It's we've had global catastrophes before.
This isn't just hypothetical.
I think that you're absolutely right in bringing up how polarization, at least on an online platform, has led to in real life demonstrations, whether that be at the Capitol building or within Myanmar's government. And those are important things to recognize. But on the flip side of that, I think that there's incredible opportunity when it comes to social media. It can be used as a force to connect people in such a interesting and new way. We see this with TikTok. I don't know about you guys, but I learned so many cool things on TikTok, from cooking recipes to, new dance moves or just a travel hack. I think that it's technology and social media can be informational and it can connect people. I think you even have individuals like Greta Thunberg. I always mess up her name. Greta, if you're ever listening to this, I'm so sorry. But I think that, this is just another way of how people have been able to articulate a message that is important, like climate change, or, just bring folks together. And that's really where the magic lies within social media. And I think that another thing that these engineers and developers were trying to communicate was that was the goal in the beginning. It wasn't to segment the entire population of the world into different categories, but to ultimately bring people together, find common ground, and sort of live a little bit more harmoniously than they had in the past.
So I want to just focus on something you said there. This is kind of my perspective, and you guys can say if I'm wrong, but I think that the power, not for good or bad, the power of social media is world building, right? And so they encourage you to do this so much. So I have Snapchat groups, right, where it's you select who's going to be in that group, who's going to see it. It's going to be a shared reality or a shared world that we're going to experience together. And social media is tailored to make, it builds worlds. And so, but then I think this also has a very negative effect where, different people are seeing different news. Different people are getting different information. And so I guess it's been a kind of a humbling thing for me, because when I see people say things on social media or online that I'm I don't. When you can't fathom how someone could say something like that, I think it's a pretty safe bet that they're literally immersed in a different world than the one you're living in. Because if your perspective is so different that what they're saying seems completely foreign, there's a safe bet that that's actually what's going on. So the power of social media, I think, is world building, but it's so customizable that it actually hasn't brought a lot of harmony at all.
To piggyback on what you were saying, Lawrence, I'm totally with you, and I totally get what you're saying. The one question I have, you're saying about how you've had these positive interactions with social media or whatever. I think the question I have that I think this film does a good job at illuminating is, So we can use social media more or less like that at times. But what do we do when we hear from those designers, though, that while we're getting some of that out there, the major goal in specifically built into these platforms about how they were created is one, to cut down our attention span so that you're constantly needing more.
Yeah, like Vines are only allowed, or Reels are only allowed to be a certain amount of seconds long, right? Like they have to be super short.
Yeah, and any kind of video you do on, whether it's, you know, you quick record a video on Snapchat, whatever else, they're all timed. It's it's meant to not keep your attention for long. It's meant to shut down your attention span. And like that's built in, it's hardwired into it. It's also hardwired into it to create basically your own world where your own interests are always king. Where you are not necessarily introduced to differing viewpoints. Basically, if you could easily be moved into a state of being that is very hardwired to be vehemently opposed to anything
other than what you're exposed to.
And that's the part that I think I really wrestle with, because I totally get what you're saying, but then I guess for me on the flip side is like these things were not designed to necessarily have any of those things. And if I don't consistently and always have habits that train me in a way that keep that at bay and keep the algorithm at bay as much as possible, the algorithm will have its way if there's not, if it's not super, super intentional to not have it have its way, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it does. So if I'm understanding your question correctly, it's how do you sort of beat the algorithm?
Yeah, well, and not even a question, but I was just saying like that for me is the other side of the coin. Like I totally hear what you're saying, but for me, that's where the tension lies there is what about when it's legitimately designed in a way that goes against a lot of ways of human flourishing.
Yeah, I mean, I think what you're saying, it's the same question as like, is it worthwhile to try and infiltrate this for the kingdom, or is this just kind of a lost cause? You know what I mean? Like, there's some things it's like, I mean, just to use a bad example, like, you wouldn't want to go be, I don't know. Like, there's just some modes that you just really can't redeem. And so is this one of them, I guess?
Yeah. I'm not sure if I would say it's unredeemable. Again, I just recognize the potential that's here. And I think even one way, just to answer your question quickly, one way that I've started or that I was able to make sure that I'm not just getting like one viewpoint. I remember when I first got Twitter, I made sure that, you know, I'm pretty liberal in my understanding of the world. But I made sure that I got, you know, everyone from like CNN to Fox News, AP, Al Jazeera. I subscribe to all of it. And so in a way, I get everything. Like I get everything from like Ben Shapiro to, I don't know what would be his, like, you know, I guess you could say Chris Cuomo. Everything comes in, and that's helpful. But at the same time, I also recognize that, you know, again, I have to take that moment of consciousness to step away from social media at times and say, okay, this isn't necessarily real life. This is the best snapshots of what's happening in the world or whatever anyone wants to put up. But then there are other times where, you know, I really do recognize social media doing me a great justice. I don't know if you guys have Snapchat or not, but I always get a little like bump of joy when I'm able to like open up like
a little dopamine hit.
I'm like, woo, this is great. I can see, like, you know, my friends all over the world, and I'm like, wow, I'm right here in Georgia right now, but, you know, my friend Rosie, she's out in London right now, and I can actually see this. And, you know, it's like one of the great perks of like technology and living in the age that we do. We can feel so connected. And then we can continue conversations about what's happening globally, but synchronously at the same time. And so I'd be really interested in seeing more of that happening in conjunction with, you know, just those moments of awareness and sort of taking a step back.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like most of the things we talk about here, it's not a yes or no question. Yeah. Because, I mean, I don't think it's even, it's not even up in the air. Like this podcast wouldn't happen if it wasn't for social media.
Well, and I think that's the thing that we're talking about, like, where do we go from here now after
right.
seeing something
yeah,
like this?
Let's move
and
to
I
that.
Think,
yeah.
but I think, like, with what you're even saying right there, like, that question almost doesn't fit even with where we're at with social media. Because, like, David Foster Wallace, he's an American novelist, but he once wrote, he said, there are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet this older fish swimming the other way. And he nods at him and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over at the other and goes, "What the heck is water?"
Yeah.
And I think what this film does is help us realize that we're swimming in this water, and you can't really get out of it. Yeah. It is the age
yeah.
we live
yeah,
in.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But I think the important thing is to realize that the water is fairly toxic.
Yeah, it's not neutral.
And the water is not neutral. It is the air we breathe. But it is definitely, it has what we could call a telos or a trajectory. Yeah. It's wanting yeah. to form us. It is a formative practice to engage in social media. Or I would even argue that's more of a deformative practice to engage in social media in a lot of ways.
It has values of its own.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. It yeah. Yeah. It is trying to take you into a certain understanding of what it means to be human.
Mm-hmm. And you cannot enter that space and use it and remain unchanged.
Right.
Because yeah. I think that's the yeah. myth we sometimes give ourselves.
Right.
And I know, like, that's something I fight with because, like, I like to write things. I like to make, like, videos. It's so, like, I need social media mm-hmm. as a distribution platform. So I'm like, well, I'll just use it for what it's good for me for, what it's good, how it can benefit me, and I won't let it affect me. But, like, that's completely naive. You cannot right. go in there and remain unchanged.
Right.
Right. We need to move. One thing I really liked at the end, they had Jonathan Haidt, and maybe you could say, what is he? He's a thinker, philosopher.
He's a social psychologist. He's a Jewish atheist, so it's kind of an interesting mix.
Okay.
But
that is interesting. Yeah.
But he has some very fascinating things to say, in which I could really resonate with a lot of stuff he writes.
So
read some of his books.
Kind of at the end of the documentary, Jonathan Haidt comes on, and he gives his three rules kind of regarding the social dilemma. And I thought these were really insightful. The first one, Lawrence kind of talked about, but all devices out of the bedroom 30 minutes before bedtime. So he's kind of drawing a clear distinction mm-hmm. between, you know, you're not just falling asleep to the droll of the blue screen in your eyes. Like, we're setting a limit here, putting the technology. That's not really the. I hate using the word technology for social media because technology is everything.
Yeah.
But put it out 30 minutes before bedtime, whatever bedtime is for you. And I think that also helps you establish what bedtime is for you. It's not 3 a.m. when you finally quit scrolling, right? The second rule Haidt points out is no social media until high school. He says, until high school, or 16 years old.
Yeah.
And this is one that I thought was interesting. And I guarantee you, you will have to fight your kids tooth and nail if you want to do this.
Yeah.
But maybe it is the loving thing to do. No social media until high school. He says middle school is hard enough the way it is without this. But like,
and I would absolutely, I mean, I,
yeah,
you know,
Colin
people
has
feel,
this.
I would definitely. I this is my personal opinion. To me, it seems like with the amount of things, especially a middle school girl goes through already, to give her Instagram is a very bad decision.
Yeah. And I mean, it's like that's such a loaded proposition because it's like it's not only am I not exposing them to Instagram, it's I'm taking away the access to the world that most actually all of the kids her age are living
right.
in most of the time.
And we're talking
at
about
least 8 hours a day.
And
right?
like what you said earlier, like we're making worlds. That's how social media is designed.
Yeah.
And so really what the pressure then is you have a hard time sharing enough reality or enough of a world with all your other peers
to
have
make a meaningful existence.
To have a meaningful existence,
yeah,
which is incredibly difficult spot to be in.
Yeah. So I mean maybe it takes much more creative answers.
Right.
Like, we're going to need a community of people who are dedicated to not letting their kids have social media until high school because I don't really see you doing this in isolation. Like, your kid's going to buy a phone behind your back and get on there.
Right.
I don't know. I'm not a parent. But, yeah, I could see that happening. Rule number three from Haidt, he says, work out a time budget for devices with your kids. And actually, I think this is something that parents have really picked up on, and at least in my limited experience, done a really good job with. Like, I know my mom did this with us and does this with my brother, my younger brother. Like, we're going to work together. We're going to decide a time limit that we think is appropriate, and then we're going to keep you to it. And it's going to keep you – because we all know, man, if you just sit down with your phone, it's endless. Like, a book ends. A movie ends. The internet does not end.
Scrolling
does not
end.
You can sit there
for
as long as you can stay awake. So work out a time budget with your kids that you're going to agree on. And it was funny. My counseling professor was asking us – she was like,
she has a 10-year-old son, I think, and she was, or 13-year-old. She was like, what do you guys think is an appropriate time? Because, like, we're going back and forth on this. And, you know, like, this is something parents are having to work out in real time. Like, what is an appropriate time? Yeah. Do you guys have, like, a number? Because, like, I was like, hour and a half, 2 hours? Like, that's something that seems reasonable to me. Maybe that's because what I do.
Definitely not my 14 hours day. I don't think that that's great. I don't know. I think if you really want it to be mindful of it, probably, you know, 3 hours a day. That gives you plenty of time. And then you have, you know, books, movies, hanging out with your friends. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to be Uncle Scrooge over here.
Or, like, if you're taking height seriously, it would be none. Yeah.
I would.
Well, okay. There's a difference between screen time and social media time,
though. That was the distinction I was going to make. Okay. If we're talking, you know, I know for me growing up, we were allowed to have, if we could keep grades up in school, we were allowed to have 30 minutes of PlayStation 2, play MLB The Show. We're allowed to have that.
Yeah, don't be hating on that, kids. That's some good stuff. Oh, yeah.
I forget if that was every day or every other day.
Yeah.
But I thought that was pretty good. And then on weekends, we could have more, like an hour. I think I honestly would stay. I mean, I might be kind of Scroogey and all that, but especially social media, I think I'd cut most of that out completely. Just because, especially with the endless scroll, all that kind of stuff, it's a rabbit hole and it does no good. I would definitely, for me, there would even be a nuance in games somewhat. Mm-hmm. Like a game like Minecraft, I think I could actually get into, I think that game's premise is a solid one that encourages and builds positive brain function. Mm-hmm. And would actually be formative in a good direction for my kid. So that one I could be more sympathetic to, a little longer time on it, extended time.
One of my classmates pointed out, it's also like you could have a time limit for your kids alone on screen time, but then like be like, hey, I'll play MLB with you. And like, we can actually do this together. We'll play a game together. And, like, that could be something a little different.
Yeah.
All right, you guys ready for my hot take to end this thing?
Give us a hot take.
I think I could be totally wrong because no one knows what's going to happen. I think Instagram is going to be a thing of the past within the next, I hesitate to say it, but I think 5 years, 10 years.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be lame. And I could be totally wrong on this. But the one thing I thought was really insightful, it was a young girl, one of the developers of Instagram, said at the end, was like, she compared it to the shopping mall. She was like, that used to be like the popular hub. Everybody wanted to get to the mall because like that's where the culture was happening, the creative stuff. That was cool. Like, you just wanted to get to the mall. She's like, malls are dying. Malls are just tracks for elderly people to walk now. But I don't know. I just kind of have a feeling that Instagram is going to be really uncool. And like, there's going to be a new movement where like the truly hip, cool, creative people like – don't do Instagram anymore because that's like so popular. And that's what happens with everything, right? Okay. Like once it becomes super popular, then you subvert it and do something else to be the minority cool kids. And so I'm saying within the next 5 years, we're going to be done with Instagram. That's my hot take.
Can I give you my hot take?
Yeah.
I think
we're going to die on Instagram.
I think in the next 5 might be a little soon, maybe 10. I think within the next 10 years, I think in the same way we see Surgeon General's warnings on like cigarette labels, things like that, I think we will start seeing them with some social media platforms, simply because the scientific consensus is growing stronger and stronger and stronger about how social media reorders our brains, and it is terrible for middle school age kids especially. And so I think I could see something till like you're 16 kind of thing. You have to have a parent or someone above 18 or something like that with you. But maybe. I don't know. Maybe not quite that extreme. I could at least see warning labels like you see on a cigarette thing. So that's my hot take prediction thing.
Lawrence, any incredibly hot takes from you before we close it out?
Yeah, just a comment for both of yours. All right. I would honestly love to see that because I think that...
Well, we're completely wrong. Yeah,
you're all wrong. No, I'd honestly love to see just like that warning. And I think that a lot of tech companies are starting to recognize the damage that they're creating. So I could see... not necessarily like a Surgeon General's warning, you know, too much time here will rot your brain.
Right.
But maybe Instagram might decide, hey, we recognize this is a problem for middle schoolers. This is Instagram for kids. And that could be a potential solution where the algorithm is a little less aggressive.
Maybe no auto scroll or like constant refresh kind of thing. Maybe.
Yeah, and you even see this on like TikTok. There's this like one guy, I can't remember who he is. He's an influencer of some sort. If you're there for a couple of hours, as I have been, he'll come on and he's like, I get how easy it is to like continue to scroll, but it's time to go to bed or like time to like go outside, like look at the sun. Don't look at the sun, but be in the sun. And then it just like closes off. Great point, Javen. Huh. To your point of Instagram being dead, I think that we've within the digital marketing and advertising world, we've noticed a trend that people are becoming a lot less interested with static, non-dynamic pictures. They're wanting video and content that's a little bit more engaging in that way. And so, it's important to realize that these platforms are adaptive because again they want to keep your attention I can totally see
it's gonna adapt to stay alive.
It's gonna fight before it gives out, but I guess I can see your point. 5 years, I don't know, I'm not Houdini. I can't, you know, do this sort of magic, but
all right, time will tell.
We're gonna leave the link for you in the Google show notes, which or the Google doc, which is always in the show notes. And it's called Why I Resolved to Quit Social Media or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really good link. And it's a good article by...
Josh Gibbs.
Yeah, go read that article. If you're on the edge about maybe giving up social media, maybe that would be...
He's got 9 fairly convincing reasons.
Yeah, 9 reasons to give up social media by the end of last year. Or this year.
It's 21. Yeah, he writes the post every year, I think.
So okay, interesting.
Trying to convince people. For the last 2 years, because he's given up, I think, for 2 years.
And then he posted on social media for everyone to read. Okay, thank you guys for tuning in, and we'll see you again next week.